Now, the practice of loving kindness and the practice of recollection of the Buddha's good qualities will stop fear from arising in your meditation, if you do it with a reasonable stillness of mind. The foulness of the body you'll start to let go of attachments more easily. And the reflection on death puts the urgency to really go for it. But not put too much effort and too much energy into it, but just that awareness that this can happen, I can die right now. I was at a meditation center in Malaysia, and there was a lady that died during the meditation. She just fell over. It can happen to any of us at any time. Not being content with wholesome acts and not shrinking from exertion. This is a wonderful one. Not being content with wholesome acts means once you've done a wholesome act, don't sit back on your heels and think how good you've done. Do some more. And that's what the exertion is talking about. Continually do this. When you practice your generosity, just because you did it today, don't wait till tomorrow to practice it again. Practice your generosity in as many ways as you can figure out how to do it. Saying things that make people happy. Doing things that are truly helpful for someone else. That's how you exert that energy. Now, knowledge and liberation. Now, vijja does not mean knowledge. Vijja means wisdom. And vimutti is purity, not liberation. That kind of changes the whole thing around now, doesn't it? Well, developing wisdom. How do you develop wisdom? What is that really? Developing wisdom. No? Anicca, dukkha, anatta. Seeing everything as impermanent, unsatisfactory, and impersonal. Now these are words that you hear over and over and over and over and over again, and after a while they really don't have much meaning until you have the experience. When you see truly that everything is changing, you don't really see it clearly until you get into the arupa jhanas, until you get into the higher immaterial jhanas. When you start seeing consciousness arise and pass away, many of my students would come to me and they would say, you know, I see this and I see it very clearly, but it's really tiresome. Because you're seeing consciousnesses arise and pass away, go out continually, continually, continually. And you're seeing the dissatisfaction in that, the suffering. Oh, I just wish it would stop and give me a break. They won't go any deeper until they can let go and let that suffering be. And see it as impersonal. Now what happens when you start seeing consciousnesses arise and pass away so fast? You see that there is no control. At first it's kind of fun, and then it gets unsatisfactory, and then you start seeing that it's just happening by itself. I can't help it. There's all these consciousnesses continually. It doesn't matter if I get up and I take a step, I see thousands and thousands of consciousnesses arise and pass away just in the feel of my foot touching the floor. Or seeing an object, you see those consciousnesses arise and pass away continually, or hearing a sound, and it gets real tiresome. And that's when you really start letting go of all attachment. So, the wisdom is developed by seeing this, by seeing the arising and passing away, and suffering and not self. As you go deeper into your meditation, you'll get to a place where all perception and feeling stop. There is no perception, there is no feeling. You don't even know you're in that state till you get out of it. When you get out of that state and your mindfulness is strong, you will see all of the links of dependent origination arise, and then you'll see if this one doesn't arise, then that one won't arise, and if that doesn't arise, this won't arise. It doesn't matter whether you know what the links of dependent origination are or not. It happens automatically. Why? Because that's the way it is. Right after that is when Nibbana occurs. I don't know how to describe Nibbana. Nobody can. But what happens to the meditator after this experience is such relief and so much happiness that you can hardly sit still. And that's when a student would come to me and they'd tell me, oh, I had this experience and I saw dependent origination. I say, fine, now go sit. And they can't. They're too happy. And that happiness lasts for a long period of time. I say a long period of time. And this is the destruction of the defilements. This is how it occurs. The defilements won't even arise anymore. Now, if you practice Vipassana with most people, they'll tell you, when you have the experience of Nibbana, then the first time that happens, you've become a Sotapanna. That means a stream enterer. And the next time it happens, then you become an Anagami. That means a once returner. And the next time that happens, you become an Anagami. And then the next time that happens, you become an Arahat. That is not in agreement with the suttas. In the Satipatthana Sutta, which happens to be in this book, it says, whoever monks should practice these four foundations of mindfulness for just 7 years may expect one of two results. One of two. We're not talking about four here. It says either arahatship in this lifetime, or if there should still be a little bit of attachment, you'll become a non-returner. Let alone 7 years, whoever should practice for just 6 years, 5 years, 4 years, 2 years, or 3 years, 2 years, 1 year, may expect one of the two results. Let alone 1 year, whoever should practice for 7 months, 6 months, 5 months, 4 months, 3 months, 2 months, half a month, may expect one of two things to occur. Now, it's not talking about you have to become a stream enterer and then a once returner and a non-returner and then an arahat. It's not talking about that at all. It says very plainly, if you're practicing the way that he's teaching, you're either going to be an arahat or an anagami. Now, where did these other two stages come in? People became sotapanna, stream enterer, or once returner by straightening out their views, by letting go of their view. And you see that in the first discourse that the Buddha gave. One of the monks he was talking to became a sotapanna while he was talking. How did that occur? Some questions he had as to the way things worked got cleared up, and his mind became so pure that he experienced Nibbana. The only way you can get to the top two stages is through meditation. Interesting stuff. And that's where the destruction of the defilements occurs. There's 10 defilements. Maybe I can get them all out. I can't remember. Doubt. A belief in a lasting, permanent self. A belief that rites and rituals will get you enlightened. And this is, it doesn't matter whether it's wrong rites and rituals or right rites and rituals. During the time of the Buddha, there was some real strange spiritual practices, like this guy decided he wanted to be thought a dog was enlightened, so he started acting like a dog. And he thought this ritual will help him to get Nibbana. And he went to the Buddha and found out that it'll get him to be a dog. And okay, those are the first three. Then there's lust and hatred. Now these five are given up when you become an anagami. There's still five fetters after that. The desire for... Oh boy. The desire for continued existence in an immaterial realm. That's a fetter. Pride is a fetter. Restlessness. Sloth and torpor. Ignorance. Those are the 10 fetters. I'm impressed. I remembered. Yeah. Rites and rituals do not lead to Nibbana. It means rites and rituals do not lead to Nibbana. My coming in here and bowing to the Buddha is not going to get me enlightened. It is a show of respect, and it's very nice to do. It helps you to be in tune with the Buddha's teaching. But it's not going to directly lead you to Nibbana. Okay. Now, when it says knowledge of the destruction of the defilements and of their non-recurrence, what that really is talking about is they are gone. They're not in your personality anymore. It won't arise for any reason at any time. Now, without these fetters, being around an arahat is an incredibly nice thing. It's really good, because you're around a person that doesn't have anything that's pulling his mind down. He is absolutely clear. He doesn't have any attachments to anything. He's clear. So you got a question, go to an arahat and ask the question. The trick is finding one. Yeah. They still sleep. Oh, yeah. They got very alive. Completely alive. When you get to be an anagami or an arahat, you have the ability to be able to sit in the state of neither perception the cessation of perception and feeling. And you can sit for 7 days. And I told you last time I had a teacher that could do that. And it was a true joy being around her. And I asked her, why do you want to sit for 7 days? And she gave me a one-word answer. Relief. The Buddha was an arahat. A Buddha is a person that, one, has taken a bodhisattva vow and renounces the enlightenment, even though he could get it in that lifetime. He renounces it. And he goes and he purifies all of his, they call them parami, all of his good qualities. That's patience and loving kindness and all kinds of different things like that. And he purifies them. He goes around, now, there's actually three kinds of Buddha. One Buddha is called a moral Buddha, and one is an energetic Buddha, and one is an intelligent Buddha. That doesn't mean that all of them aren't moral and energetic and intelligent. They just differentiate between the three. To become a moral Buddha, that means that you have to go around the wheel of samsara for 16 Mahakappas. Now, a Mahakappa is one complete cycle of the expansion and contraction of the universe. One complete cycle of the expansion and contraction of the universe. Now, there's a thing called an asankhya, and this is a fourth of that. The universe is still for one asankhya. Now, the Buddhists have tried to put this into numbers to give you some kind of an idea. It's 10 to the 160th power. That's how many years it takes. That they're just sitting still. Okay, now this is when it's all contracted and then the Big Bang happens. And then for one asankhya, there's expansion of the universe. And that's when life occurs on planets. And then it stops for one asankhya. And then it contracts for one asankhya. So we're talking about 10 to the 540th power years for one. Now, a moral Buddha does that for 16 of those. He told him. He didn't say the numbers, but he did say that there are these kind of Buddhas, and he even named some of them. We saw him in the past. Now, they purify themselves a lot, and they go through lifetime after lifetime. And one of the things about a bodhisattva is when they're reborn into a heavenly realm, they don't want to be there anymore. So quite often they're reborn into the Devaloka. In the Devaloka, you have to eat food. You have to take some kind of sustenance every day or you die. And then you're reborn in another realm. or if you're born in the Brahma Loka from doing meditation, your food is joy. So you cut off the joy. And then you die out of that realm and reborn in another realm. They always want to be reborn in the human realm as much as they possibly can. That's where they can purify themselves the most. Now, they keep on being reborn over and over and over and over millions and millions and millions of times, purifying themselves by their actions and their deeds and their speech, until finally they've purified enough, and then they can be reborn into the human realm and be a Buddha. Now, when a moral Buddha is born, the lifespan of human beings is a lot longer than it is right now. It's more like 100,000 years. And he doesn't give any, quote, Dhamma teaching to people. They become enlightened just by seeing his example. He might give two or three teachings in his entire life. And these are the Buddhas that don't... they have monks that follow them, but they're all so pure that they don't give the Vinaya rules. So as soon as a Buddha dies, then the Buddha era starts to fade away very quickly. But it's been around for 100,000 years or so it's been around for a long time. The next kind of Buddha is called the energetic Buddha, and he is he's a bodhisattva for 8 mahakappas. One expansion and contraction of the universe. And when he's born, he is about the lifespan of human beings is corroded and is down to about 15 or 20,000 years, something like that. Now, whether I really believe these lifespans or not, I'm not sure. Okay, so don't... I have read it in the text, but I have my doubts still. So I'm just reporting what I've read. No. Absolutely not. Rebirth. We talked about it last time. No. He is an intelligent Buddha. That's right. Right. The reason he's called an intelligent Buddha is he got to become a Buddha after only 4 mahakappas. Yeah. He was exceptional. He was very intelligent. He worked very hard. And as a result, he was born during a time when the lifespan is not very long, and he didn't live very long. But he gave the rules to the monks, and that helps the Buddha's teaching stay around for a lot longer because of the discipline that monks have to keep. And it's said that the Buddha Dhamma will last about 5,000 years. So we're about halfway through. Are you impatient? Now, the reason that the Buddha is such an incredible being is because they have purified themselves for such a long time. They are, it's like you take a bottle and you wash it out, and you smell the inside of the bottle and there's no odor at all. Now, an arahat is someone that can attain arahatship in this lifetime. They haven't worked so much on purifying themselves like the Buddhas do. to be a first chief disciple or second chief disciple, like Sariputta, he made the determination during one Buddha, and the next Buddha that came around, he purified himself enough to become the first chief disciple. They generally, the first chief disciple purifies himself for 2 mahakappas. And the second chief disciple is a little bit less than that, but not much. Well, I don't really think about it much. I figure that I don't want to be a Buddha. It takes too long. It's too hard. I mean, they get killed so many times and have to hold their mind so that there's not one ounce of dissatisfaction. So taking a bodhisattva vow, to me, no way. Let me get off the wheel right now. We got the Buddha's teaching. All we have to do is practice the way he says, and we can do it. Yeah. A lot of people will take a bodhisattva vow, and after 5 or 10 or 20,000 lifetimes, they realize, hey, this is tough. I don't want to do that anymore. And they give it up. See, I think this is a commentary too, so I'm not sure that it's absolutely correct. But there's 8 things that have to occur in order for you to become a bodhisattva. One of the things is that you have to have the potential to be an arahat right now and renounce it. You have to be willing to die for the Buddha. You have to take the bodhisattva vow in front of the Buddha, and the Buddha has to look into the future to see whether, in fact, you are going to be a Buddha or not. You have to have psychic powers, all fly in the air and all that kind of stuff. I can't remember the rest. Yeah. Well, but to be a Buddha is not an easy thing. You have to be willing. And do that in front of the Buddha. But you have to have all of these abilities and just say, no, I don't want to do that. I'll give it up. Yeah, something like that. No. No. The Buddha doesn't look at those kind of things at all. Yeah. But he rejected a lot of different kinds of questions because they were only speculation, and that's all. And that's what a belief in God is. It's a speculation. It's a concept. And we're dealing with reality. And I'm done for today. So let's share some merit. May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, Devas and Nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu.